Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Hello, can you hear me? Hello, can you hear me? Well, Terry, I can hear me on the internet, and but I don't hear you. Well, Terry, I can hear me on the internet, and but I don't hear you. Terry, do you hear me now?
I can hear somebody.
Well, that's me, but I...
Terry, do you hear me now?
I can hear somebody.
That's Red. Where
that's me, but I... Terry, do you hear me now?
Where's Terry at?
That's Red. Where's me, but I...
I don't know, Red. Terry must be having some technical problems.
Yeah, well, I was late getting on, and I've dialed now four times.
Well, I called him, and he said he had an open mic for me. Maybe we ought to just talk. It's awful to have dead mic or dead air when you have a program.
Yeah.
me hang up and try to call him again and see if he's aware that he's dead, not on the air.
Yeah, I'll hang on.
All right, bye. Red, can you hear me?
Yes.
Apparently, Terry's having some difficulties, can't get on, so he suggested that you and I talk, and we'll see what happens if you can get it fixed.
Yeah, who am I talking to?
This is William Taylor Ryle. I met you at the Continental Congress in 2009, where you spoke.
Yeah.
And, I followed you actually through the years and read your two-volume book on the law that never was many years ago. So it's a pleasure to be on the air with you.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yes. Welcome.
I had to call in on my phone because the host line nobody could hear the host line.
Okay, so that's all fixed. That's great.
I was talking and nobody was hearing me. So... I actually opened with a really good prayer, but I guess it eventually worked. I should have prayed before I started the show, I think, tonight. So welcome back to Walls in Our Minds, Bill Ryle, and I introduced you a while ago as the chairperson of the Pennsylvania Sheriff's Brigade, and I think the folks here have heard a little bit about you and know of you know, some idea if they listened to the show a few weeks ago. You might just give them a little refresher about who you are and what you're about. And I thought we would, since Red's here with us, maybe we could start out this conversation tonight on nullification.
That'd be great. Well, my name is William Taylor Ryle, and I'm the founder and executive director of the County Sheriff Brigades of Pennsylvania. We have a website I would encourage everybody to visit, and that's sheriffbrigadesofpenn.com. And you can learn about what we're doing here in Pennsylvania. I actually started my involvement with Sheriff Richard Mack in 2008, and he asked me to be the state coordinator for Pennsylvania for the Sheriff Project, which is what it was called at that time. In 2010, he left that organization and started another one that's now the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, of which we are a part. And we're trying to implement a program here in Pennsylvania that organizes each county to a people who will be ready and able to support the sheriff when he acts constitutionally and, in fact, encourage him to do so, and if he chooses not to, then to find someone who will follow their oath. And we're having some success. It's slow, unfortunately, because people are so oftentimes deceived by other programs that may appear to be quicker or easier or instantaneous. But this is hard work, getting people educated and networked together in order to solve some very serious problems that we have in this country, which frankly, it's been going on for over 150 years, so it's not a new problem.
Well, I tell you, we're blessed that our listeners tonight have been patient and waited for all these technical difficulties to to go away. Red, give us a quick definition of what nullification is, if you could.
Nullification. If you've got a law that has been written by a bunch of politicians, lawyer politicians, that is designed to take power away from the people and put that power, the people's power, into the government. That is not good law in this country. I don't know if there's any other country that has really had much in the way of nullification. We've got some feedback, I guess.
Yeah, we're getting, somebody's got a computer speaker still on. You need to, if you got a phone on, you can't have your computer speaker on.
Yeah, well, anyway, nullification was something that the founders back in 1787, they understood it very, very well. They knew about the trial of the originator, I guess, of who am I talking about, Terry? You're going to have to help me out here. The state of Pennsylvania was founded. Help me out here.
Well, maybe I can help you out. This is Bill Ryle.
William Penn.
There you go.
William Penn was prosecuted back in the 1600s, about 1670-something, and because he had run afoul of a law that the politicians and the king and the Church of England liked very well, and they had that law passed that there was no other religion allowed in England, and William Penn, of course, he's got a different theology, and he is preaching it in London, and he runs crosswise to that law. And when they prosecuted him, he could have been executed if he had been found guilty. That's how tough that law was, that if you run afoul of that law, you could be executed. And but they did have the juries, and that come under Magna Carta, of course. And they prosecuted William Penn, and the jury came out and said not guilty. And he was guilty of violating that law, no question about it. I mean, he did not deny that he was preaching this different different theology, and it was obvious to the jury as well. But the jury said not guilty. The judge, of course, he was a government employee. He has a conflict of interest because he is paid a salary from tax monies by the government and one thing and another. And the judge is highly perturbed, and he tries to get the jury to change their minds. And the jury said no. William Penn is not guilty. And that was a very, very important case that was recorded in history. And the founders of this country, when they put together the Constitution for the United States of America and the Bill of Rights, they knew all about the trial of William Penn. And so they made sure that power, of course, they had their hearts set on creating a system of government where the people were the masters and the government was a servant. The people working for government were servants. The judges on the government payroll were public servants. And so they pretty well tried to get that into our system. And, of course, it has been there all the time. But when the government took over the schools back in the mid-1800s, they started running the schools, controlling the schools. They quit teaching about jury nullification. So we've ended up with three or four or five generations of people in this country who were never taught anything about jury nullification of bad law. We weren't supposed to have the power to determine whether a law was good or bad. We were to just determine whether the law had been violated. And, of course, this was totally contrast to what Magna Carta had decreed and the Constitution and Bill of Rights had demanded on the part of our government in this country. And it has not been until the last 50 years that there's been people talking about nullification. And, of course, that all has come about because our government has been passing a lot of bad law. Law that is not to protect the people and their sovereignty and protect their power, their position as masters, because government has always wanted to be the master. They've always wanted to be the power. They've always wanted to be become dictators. The bureaucrats are just tin horn bureaucrats is what they are if you don't have jury nullification. And so we're experiencing those problems today in this country, and so nullification is coming on like gangbusters right now. And I'm just glad I'm still around to be a part of it.
Well, Bill, you might add to that and talk about other forms of nullification besides jury nullification.
Yeah, and of course I'm very familiar with the William Penn Hatt trial of 1670, and I'll sort of supplement that later. But actually I think the term of nullification really says that if the government at any level, does something that's immoral or unconstitutional, the people or the counties or the states or, frankly, the central government has the authority, if the state does something unconstitutional, for example, to say that it's unconstitutional and not enforce it. Nullification doesn't repeal a law, an alleged law. It just says that it will not be enforced or implemented in the jurisdiction which you're trying to nullify it. So I tend to talk about nullification in the following way. First of all, we all, and we're sovereigns in this country, and of course that may be a foreign concept to some people, but it's certainly been confirmed repeatedly by the courts. It's also an understanding in our Constitution here in Pennsylvania. It's Article 1, Section 2, all powers in the people, and all governments are instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness. You can also look at the Declaration of Independence and the consent of the governed. But in 1934, the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, and there are many examples, in Perry versus U.S., it's 294 U.S. 331, and this quote comes from page 353 of that decision. It says, in the United States, sovereignty resides in the people, who acts through the organs established by the Constitution. It gives a whole bunch of cases. And it goes on, the Constitution as an instrumentality of sovereignty is endowed with certain powers to be executed on behalf of the people in the manner and with the effect the Constitution ordains. Congress cannot invoke the sovereign power of the people to override their will as thus declared, end quote. And so since the people are sovereign, you as an individual, everyone has the power and the authority to say no when government tries to get you to do something or not do something. Of course, you got to know what you're talking about and be willing to defend it. But that's individual nullification, and I hope people begin to exercise that more. Of course, as I said, you need to understand a lot when you start telling government that they're not right. Then I think it's the county government, particularly the sheriff, has the authority to say no when anybody comes into the county and is trying to affect the people of that county. By telling them, no, you can't do that in this county because it's unlawful or it's immoral. And ask them to leave, and if they won't leave, escort them to the border of the county, and if not, find a place for them to spend a night or two in the jail. Well, the jury, as Red explained, has that authority as well. The people make up the jury. That's the people of the community, the county, that can say, even though the individual did what the alleged law says he can't do, you find him not guilty, and just one individual on that jury can do that. And in fact, the story that Red talked about, William Penn, actually he and William Meade were put on trial for preaching Quakerism in the Church of London, Christ Church in London. And that was against the law. The Anglo-Saxon or Anglican Church was the only recognized church, and in so doing, preaching in public contrary to that church was a crime, and the penalty of that crime was death. And so they were put on trial. As it turns out, William's father really encouraged William Jr. to behave himself, to show some respect from the courts, and to take his hat off when he went into the court, which he did. And the judge ordered the hat be put back on his head and then found him in contempt for having his hat on. And that sort of set the tone for the trial. The gallery, of course, was awakened by that act, that terrible act by the court, and it became known as the hat trial for that reason. But at any rate, he, that is William Penn, had actually studied law in Paris. His father had sent him to Paris, and he studied a little bit of law in Paris. So he defended himself and William Meade in that trial and was found by the judge to be out of order many times. And also when the jury came back with a not guilty plea, the judge of the case put the jury in the jail and kept them there. And finally, 8 of the 12 jurors acquiesced, but 4 did not. And the head of the jury, the foreman, was a fellow named Edward Bushell. He was a very wealthy merchant in London at the time. And he said that his vote was not for sale, and they held out for many weeks in the jail under deplorable conditions. And then finally, I think it was the Queen who interceded, and the jury came out and held to the fact that William Penn and William Meade were not guilty, and the not guilty verdict was upheld. And so we get a lot from that trial. We get, first of all, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, trial by jury. In fact, William Penn wrote a petition for writ of habeas corpus to get the jurors out of jail. And so we have that example as well. But these were provisions that were already English law. It was just the fact that the courts were not recognizing it. And that's an excellent example of jury nullification. Another one here in America is the John Peter Zenger case of August 4th, 1735, where Zenger was charged with libel, slanderous libel, because he criticized through his paper the governor of New York. And his attorney, Andrew Hamilton, argued that truth was a defense, and very quickly the jury came back with a not guilty verdict, because he had in fact violated this Sedition Act that was published in New York. But of course the jury disagreed with it. Another example, of course, is when the federal government passed the Alien and Sedition Act in 1798 that said that to speak out against President Adams and the Federalist Congress was a crime, and you could be charged, arrested, fined for those alleged charges. Conspicuously absent from the list of protected individuals was Thomas Jefferson. Now, he was the vice president, and they didn't like him, obviously, because he was an anti-federalist, right, Republican. And so he was not covered by the Sedition Acts. And also interesting, the Sedition Acts were due to expire at the end of Adams's term. So it was clearly fostered by the Federalist Congress and Adams to keep people from speaking against them. Well, Thomas Jefferson and Madison disagreed with that and said that was a violation of the First Amendment, freedom of speech. And so they fought against it and came up with the Principles of 98, which in essence said the states can intervene on behalf of the people of the states when the federal government exceeds its authority. So that you have this power that the courts and the people in the county, in fact, everybody who takes an oath is supposed to evaluate what they're being asked to do, either passing legislation or enforcing it. And if it's unconstitutional, they are supposed to say, no, I will not do that, because it's against their oath of office. And that, in essence, is nullification at all levels. Probably to dispel this idea that the federal government or the state government doesn't have any authority to nullify, you might want to turn to James Madison's 51, Federalist Paper 51. And in that document, he talks about nullification. And I quote, "In a single republic, all power is surrendered by the people, is submitted to an administration of a single government, and the usurpations are guarded against by a division of the government into distinct and separate departments. In the compound republic of America," let me repeat that, "in the compound republic of America," now this was done by Madison and Jay and Hamilton trying to get the people of New York to ratify the Constitution, the federal Constitution. So here he's talking about the compound republic of America. "The power surrendered by the people is first divided between two distinct governments, and then the portions allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separate departments. Hence, a double security arises to the rights of the people. The different governments will control each other at the same time that each will be controlled by itself," end quote. Now, even Hamilton talks about this nullification authority in Federalist 28. So you could read about that in that document as well. And I'm no fan of Hamilton, but even he got it right in Federalist 28. So nullification is real. People will say it isn't. And, of course, the courts won't admit it because that goes against their alleged ultimate of power and authority. But the people are the ultimate authority, as Red indicated. And we, the people, got to start standing up and start saying no. We have to learn how to say no. In order to do that, you got to know a little bit more about history and the law, and certainly about your state constitution. In Pennsylvania, of course, we were part of the original 13 colonies that became states. Our constitution was placed in law on September 28, 1776. And this power of the juries was in, you know, trial by juries included in that original document, and it's continued there ever since. And it's true in every other state, because all the states in the Union come in to equal footing with the original 13. I think it's another thing, maybe comment here, is people often think that now we're taught that the federal government, the national government, I guess, is all-powerful. And the states are just sort of there to carry out their will, I guess. But that's not the way it actually happened. Keep in mind that the Declaration of Independence was put into force on July 4, 1776, and then the 13 colonies no longer had allegiance to the King of England, although they were all Englishmen, And so they had the task to go back to their states and write constitutions. That's what Pennsylvania did through that summer, and as I said, came and put into force on September 28, 1776, the first Pennsylvania Constitution. But all the other states either wrote constitutions or modified or used their charters and just used those as constitutions. But they were fledgling little nations, independent states, and they were called the United States of America, but they were actually 13 separate states. And they set about writing the Articles of Confederation in 1777. It was ratified in 1781, and there were inadequacies in that document. So finally in 1787, they got together in Philadelphia and decided to write a new document, and that was the Constitution of the United States, which went out to be ratified, and was ratified on June 21st, 1788, by New Hampshire, was the ninth state. And during that process, the people didn't like it. It didn't have a Bill of Rights. All the state constitutions had Declaration of Rights, and Pennsylvania's is very powerful, always has been. And so what did they do? They demanded that a Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution, which Washington said would be amongst the first works of the new Congress, and they did. And that Bill of Rights was ratified on December 15, 1791. So that became the original organic Constitution. And frankly, it's been amended unconstitutionally many, many times. Red Beckman and Benson pointed out very clearly in their Law That Never Was that the 16th Amendment wasn't properly ratified. Well, the 14th wasn't either. It wasn't proposed or ratified. So it's not part of the Constitution. And we need to examine that if we really understand how this change really started. But nullification is a powerful tool that the people have, both individually in their counties and their state. And frankly, when the states step out of bounds, the federal government is supposed to have an effective check on the states. That's what Madison was talking about.
Red, any comment to that?
Not at the moment. I was waiting for you to make a comment.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've been doing, and it's really it's gotten to be a habit with me now, is that whenever anybody refers to the United States as the nation or national or country, I just have to stop and correct them. Because this is a part of the dumbing down process that people have been conditioned by our media, by our schools, even by our pulpits, to think of the United States government as being having jurisdiction from coast to coast, from all 50 states, and having jurisdiction and reign, basically. And that's just simply not the case. Each state is its own, like you said, nation state. It is a nation, each state. Each state is a country. The United States is neither of those. The United States is a federation. And just simply stopping people and correcting them on that goes a long ways toward them thinking and realizing how badly we've been dumbed down. Would you agree with that, Bill?
Well, yes. In fact, if you think about it, and this again is in history, the individual states ratified the Constitution for the United States of America. So the states, actually the people in conventions of the states, and then the legislatures of the states ratified the Bill of Rights. But nevertheless, it was the states that are members of the compact. They're the ones that created the Constitution, which then created the government called the United States of America. So the government of the United States of America is subordinate to, and always has been, to the power of the states. And they're not on co-equal basis. And in fact, the departments in each one of the governments are not co-equal. The people, having the sovereign power, elect legislators to go and represent us in trust following the Constitution, state first and then the federal Constitution. And so that department, that is the legislative department or of the government, is the superior department because it represents the sovereign power. the Hamilton even admits that the judiciary is to be the weakest of the three branches. That's in Federalist 78. And he said we had nothing to fear as long as it didn't join with either of the other two. Well, guess what? It's taken over all three, so we have a great deal of fear from the judiciary. That leaves the executive in between. So you have the legislative as the most powerful, and then the executive, and then the judiciary. And that's true at every level of government, because that's the design here. But most important to believe, to understand, is that the states are the authority. And in fact, if you go back and read history, you'll see that very few cases went from the states to the federal courts before the war between the states, because they understood that the federal government had limited enumerated powers, and without jurisdiction, without authority, there's no way you could go to a federal court and seek redress on something that was not within their power to hear. Well, the war between the states gave great opportunity to change that. People were always trying to do it. But then the so-called 14th Amendment turned that around. What does it say? It starts out by saying, all persons born or naturalized in the United States are subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and citizens of the state in which they reside, rather than the way it was, and still is, frankly, because that amendment is null and void, is that you are first and foremost a citizen of the state where you're domiciled, where you make your home. And because that state is part of the union, you're also a citizen of the United States of America. Now, if you're in Washington, D.C., you're only a citizen of the United States of America. Or if you're in a territory or possession of the United States, which, by the way, is supposed to be a very temporary situation, then you're only a citizen of the United States. But there's always been this dual citizenship, just like Madison said, in this compound republic, where you have two citizenships. So that's a piece of history that, frankly, people have forgotten. And it also goes back to why do we have that war between the states. It was over states' rights. It had very little to do with sovereignty. That was used, slavery. That was used as a reason and certainly was wrong all along. But the war was not over slavery. That's a misconception that we've been taught wrongly.
Right, yeah, I don't think we want to go there right now. One of the things, though, we look at these things like the 14th Amendment. That really was the 15th Amendment. When we look at the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, the 17th Amendments, none of them have been properly ratified. How do we go about nullifying the de facto that just artificially puts things in like they've been a properly made constitutional law, and in fact, it's not law at all, and yet they just enforce it like it is, and the people allow that to go on. How do we nullify that?
Oh, I think it's education first. People need to know that it isn't law, and there's a, I'm sure everybody's had access to the Citizens Rule Book. It's a little pamphlet and contains a whole lot of good information. And on page 7 of that document, there's a list of cases that you can refer to. The first one being Marbury versus Madison, 1803. And oh, by the way, if you read that opinion, it's not what the attorneys tell you it says. But nevertheless, it says, quote, all laws which are repugnant to the Constitution are null and void. So if no matter what somebody does, and, of course, he's referring to the federal constitution there because that's a federal jurisdiction. But it's true with all others. In fact, in Marbury versus Madison, Marshall makes that point very clear in his closing comments in that opinion. He says, quote, the framers of the Constitution contemplated the instrument as a rule of the government of courts as well as the legislature. Why does a judge swear to discharge his duties agreeable to the Constitution of the United States if that Constitution forms no rule of his government? And it goes on a little ways, and then later it says, if such be the real state of things, That is worse than solemn mockery, and to prescribe or take an oath becomes equally a crime. What he talked in that interim was the fact that the courts needed to examine the laws. He closed that out by saying, thus the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle supposed to be essential to all written constitutions. Courts, as well as other departments, are bound by that instrument. That's a very powerful quote from what's supposed to be the landmark decision that gave the courts this alleged ultimate and sole authority to determine what's constitutional. That's just not true. Well, I'm sure that anybody has been stopped for a traffic citation would have been given, or any crime for that matter, would be given their Miranda Acts rights. You know, you have the right to remain silent. Well, in that same decision, they said this, quote, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislature would abrogate them. The general rule, and there are many other decisions that are similar, but the general rule found in American jurisprudence is, the general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose. Since unconstitutionality dates from the time enactment and not merely from the date of the decision so branding it, no one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. I wish they took that seriously. But the first thing that the court ought to do, or any government ought to say, is what I'm asking somebody to do or trying to decide, is it constitutional? If it isn't, stop. And that's where we've gotten to a point where we don't have peace officers anymore. We have law enforcement officers, and we have courts that frankly think they are the ultimate omnipotent power. And that's where we've lost it. The people have frankly been dumbed down to believe that you can't question government. That's just not true. Our job is, in fact, to question government, and that's what nullification's about, questioning and making sure that those in government have authority, lawful authority, to ask you to do something or not do it. And the lawful is put in there because of the very reason that you stated. So many of these amendments, alleged amendments, are unconstitutional. The 14th, 16th, 17th. Clear examples, well-documented examples, that they were not ratified properly. Of course, in the case of the 14th Amendment, they were not proposed or ratified properly. The ball begins at the so-called 14th Amendment, which switches that relationship around. And so many people have made statements about the so-called 14th Amendment, which frankly don't find themselves in truth or history. It is misapplied and abused, and it was written and rewritten by the framers of it, so it sounded real good. But the southern states saw there was wrong, and 10 of them rejected it right off the bat, and it has never been properly ratified.
Well, state of Georgia, they've nullified the 14th Amendment. They put out what they call a memorial petition in 57 that became an aged document in 2007. When states put out those sorts of petitions and they're not responded to within 50 years, they carry the full weight of law. And that document in Georgia refuted the ratification of the 14th Amendment, and it was never responded to. So the state of Georgia has, in effect, nullified it, as well as the Utah Supreme Court has nullified it by determining in the case of Dyett versus Turner that it was never properly ratified. And, of course, even some of the states that, in fact, did so-called ratify it did so at gunpoint. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, and I think it's wise that we sort of sum this up. And I would suggest, I'm glad that Georgia did that. I would suggest that 50 years, that's not a requirement. If it, just like the general statement about unconstitutional acts, they're null and void from the time they did it, and you just have to recognize it. That's why I keep and have been talking about the so-called 14th Amendment for 20 years, in that that is the beginning which switched this relationship around. And I grew up in Atlanta in the South, so I've been exposed to states' rights my whole life. And the point being is, one alleged constitutional amendment is the source of the federal intrusion, or the central government intrusion, because they're not a federal government anymore, into the states. And if you think about it, they always tack on, you know, 1st and 14th, 4th and 2nd and 14th, 4th and 14th. That's how the courts take over alleged jurisdiction of a state issue. It's just turned upside down, and we have to turn it upside right. And I don't think you need to have a state do a resolution and wait 50 years. I mean, it's all well and good that Georgia did that. I think it's great. But in fact, there is more than enough evidence, to confirm that the so-called 14th Amendment was never properly approved or ratified. In fact, if you go on the Internet, you can probably spend years reading everything that's been written. Some of it's not true, but a great deal of it is. And if you want to get some a list of websites that I find to be credible, you can go on to our website and look at the 14th Amendment. I have two articles on there. The first one was a general article about the unconstitutionality of the 14th Amendment was never properly approved or ratified. And the second one is a description, a tutorial on two pages of why it wasn't, and that's really taken from Dyett versus Turner and other publications. But the 14th Amendment is just an amazing usurpation and a perversion of our laws, and it is, in fact, I think, the beginning of the end. And we are suffering from it every day and the expansion of the federal power. In fact, it was in 1947, as I recall, in Adamson's versus California, where the United States Supreme Court confirmed that the, in the majority opinion, that the first eight articles of the Bill of Rights couldn't be applied inside the states. But in the dissenting opinion, they said they could, and they've in fact been doing that aggressively ever since. And so when you have that kind of perversion just thrown in front of you, then I just give up on the courts. They're just not going to do what they need to be do. They have no incentive to do that. And, in fact, it's been the role for my studies of 22-plus years of the role of the certain attorneys and certain judges and justices and professors of law that have converted this country, and it could never have happened without their active involvement. And the evidence is overwhelming. And so you have to really understand these points in our history where things have been changed. And one of the methods that you use so frequently is the use of court decisions as some sort of form of law. And it's not. Court decisions or opinions are not law. They're only evidence of what the law is if, in fact, they are moral and constitutional and they apply to the situation that is under examination. But I find that most court decisions are not. They're either unconstitutional or they're unconstitutionally applied to humans. And people now really need to study the what the courts have done over the years.
Well, believe it or not, Bill, we've just about consumed the first hour. I know the first 15 minutes of this show was consumed by technical difficulties. Boy, I'm just glad we were able to finally get everybody on. We're starting to get some of our second hour guests in here. I'm going to start opening up the mics a little bit, and they can join right in our conversation, and maybe we can transition this, because basically what's going on right now over in with the Colorado Monument is something that the people need to nullify. So nullification really slides right into this conversation about what them stealing public lands and attacking private property rights and destroying economies they're trying right now to get the state of Colorado to literally cede the land that the Colorado Monument occupies. And we're going to find out from some of these guests a little bit of information about what the local people think about it. and also some of the research that's done. We've got two 970 callers with open mics now. One is 250. Who's 970-250? Would you like to announce who you are?
This is Kevin McCarney. Former second vice chair of Mesa County Republicans, and I chair a group over here called Freedom Colorado.
Well, Kevin, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. Let's see who the
Thank
other
you.
Caller is. 970-628, please say hello.
Well, hello there. This is Marjorie. How are you?
Well, hello, Marjorie. This is Marjorie Hahn, and you and Kevin, I believe, know each other.
We do.
Yes, we do.
Well, this is Bill Rowell. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
Well, thank you.
Pleasure to meet you, Bill.
I'm in Pennsylvania, but I certainly share your concerns.
And Red,
we're glad to hear that.
Red, would you like to say hello?
I sure would. I'm here in Washington State, and I'll tell you, Washington State has surprised me no end with what is going on, because I remember 25 years ago Washington was considered a lost cause because they seemed to have headed down the liberal trail and the progressives and all of that, and there has been a tremendous change in Montana. I mean, in Washington State, and, of course, Montana has been different for a long time. Montana is where my heart is, but I'm living in Washington State right now. But one of the outspoken people down at the big deal we had on the ranch down in Nevada a couple of weeks ago, one of the main leaders there was a state legislator from the state of Washington. And then I found out that there were several legislators from the state of Washington that were there. And, of course, Washington is well represented amongst the nine states that had met in Salt Lake about the time the ranch fiasco was going on down in southern Nevada. And there's a lot of great things happening, there is change in the wind. There's things happening. And I haven't heard that much about your situation there in Colorado, but you've got a lot of friends out here all across the West, especially that are going to be watching your situation there in Colorado. So I'm trying to be quiet here and listen in because I want to know what's happening in the state of Colorado.
Well, Marjorie, would you start us out and just give us a little bit of background on what's going on?
You bet. I'd be happy to. Here in western Colorado, we actually live around 20 miles from the Utah border. We're very, very close. And it's what I call John Wayne country. It's the Red Rocks. It's the valleys. It's the soaring mountains and, you know, the Red Rock spires and, you know, just beautiful land out here. It's very agricultural. The Colorado River runs very close to us. And over time, you know, since the pioneer times, well, actually previous to that, the Utes, we settled up kind of nestled against what is called the Colorado National Monument. And, you know, it's kind of a sandstone edifice. It's very beautiful for hiking, lots of wildlife. It's very wild, but it's very accessible. And we've built up our little town around this. There's subdivisions abutting this area. There's industry. There's private business. There's a school. And, you know, it's a fairly well-developed area, so it's not like any other national park. And what has happened is there's been kind of an initiative to make our national monument, which right now is fairly accessible to the local people. It's mostly used by local people, to turn that into a national park. With national park designation, the rules change. right now it's a class 2 area, which means the EPA really doesn't have a lot of authority to restrict things like haze, things like water quality, and, you know, any kind of pollution, that kind of thing. But if it becomes a class 1 area, which applies to wilderness areas and national parks, then the EPA swoops in and they can regulate anything from particulates in the air, which can be dust, to water quality, to just about everything you can imagine, not just within a national park, but for literally hundreds of miles outside of a national park. Here in Western Colorado, we literally have treasure under our feet in the form of coal, very clean, burning, powerful coal. We have natural gas. We have oil in the form of shale. And we have all of these this wealth under our feet, but that will be sequestered away from us if this becomes a national park because of those different regulations that will occur if it becomes a Class 1 area. So that's what we're afraid of. We have a great lifestyle here. People really take care of this area. It's very clean. The roads are in good repair. But with the national park, you get the change in rules with the EPA sweeping in. But you also get a different kind of tourism, mostly foreign tourists and people who are coming from out of the area who don't have an interest in caring for it, who, you know, may not be so respectful as the local people. And because of the threat that it literally presents to our lifestyles and to the future economy of this part of Colorado, there's kind of an uprising out here to oppose national park status. And Kevin and I are both part of that.
Well, Kevin, I understand that you look at this somewhat from the economic side as well, and I'd like to hear your views of this. What's your objection to the feds coming in and giving this a national park status, and what kind of impact do you see happening if they're successful?
Well, almost immediate impact would be the Forest Service has actually done a study that says that they want to ban fracking within a 100-mile radius of all national parks. Now, the major gas fields here in western Colorado are all within a 100-mile radius of Grand Junction. So if they ban fracking, they will ban all energy development on the western slope. When our past governor, Ritter, changed the oil and gas rules out here in 2010, Grand Junction went from the number one drilling area in the world to the last in the United States. We lost 8,000 jobs in that time period. Most of those went to North Dakota, where there's active drilling going on. On top of that, we kind of already see what the hand of the federal government does to the economy on the western slope. We have a large coal mining community to the south of us in the North Fork of the Gunnison Valley and down along the Dolores River. And there are two towns in particular that are just being decimated right now. One is Paonia, Colorado, and the other is Nuclea, Colorado. They're talking right now in Paonia. They have four high schools in their school district. They're talking about closing two of those schools and combining them with the other two because of the loss of population because they shut down a coal mine last year. And here's what happened. The EPA guy came in. He felt the wall of coal mine, said, hey, that feels warm to me. The guy that was with him says, yep, feels warm to me too, and they shut it down. No evidence of a fire. They had one CO detector that gave an abnormal reading. And they shut a mine down that employed almost 400 people. And it's been closed ever since. What happens is it's not just the mine that gets affected. It's the businesses that the mine supports. We have a guy here in Palisade, Colorado, runs a place that he sells supplies to oil and gas and mining. If those industries are closed down, his business of 40 years disappears. My business would be directly affected because some of my best customers are people in the oil and gas field. It's a tremendous thing, and our Senator, Mark Udall, would have you think that the draft legislation that they had written up, which says, oh, they won't change from Class 1 to Class 2, or Class 2 to Class 1, and all this is going to get through Congress without being changed. And we already know that there are lobbying groups out there that are going to force themselves into this action that have said, we're going to change the air quality to Class 1, we're going to change so that they have to have buffer zones. And it just, as Marjorie said, it becomes a whole just snowball effect going downhill that affects the entire economy. I've told people that if we put a national park here in Grand Junction, we will be able to call ourselves Fastest Park West, because we will be able to attract no high-tech industry, no energy industry of any kind. And what we'll do is go from those $40 an hour jobs down to $10 an hour tourist jobs. It'll be the end of the vibrant economy over here. People will be here to service the folks from the Eastern Slope, and apparently that's what the liberals in the state want.
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I understand the economic impact. It's unfortunately kind of affecting the entire country. But the problem that we're suffering from is that those in government don't read, study, and understand and strictly follow either the state constitution or the federal constitution.
Right.
Would you please, I would suggest that we start working on the county level and make sure that anybody that comes into your county is following their oath of office, and if they're not, tell them to leave. And generally, you know that, and that's what this Western, what is it, Coalition of Western States, I think was Red referring to, I think it's great, called COWS. They're asserting the proper authority under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, that the United States government doesn't have any authority to own land inside Colorado or any other state unless it's been agreed to by the legislature and paid for by the government. And they've been stealing from the western states all these years. I think it's great that the people are finally waking up to it, but that was evident from the original stripping off of Virginia of its massive land, and there were other states, I think about seven of them, that got put in the Northwest Ordinance in order to equal out what is supposed to happen with the states. And that land was only put in there for temporary, as a trust for temporary, until they became states. And once the states were entered the Union, became states first, and then that state was entered into the Union, the United States government have any authority to the land? None. And except for what? Forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. This massive grab, which really started with Teddy Roosevelt, his concept of executive power was anything that's not prohibited by the Constitution, the president can do. Well, that's what we're seeing just in spades today. It's towards 180 degrees the way it's supposed to be, but that was where this started. You know, Wilson was bad, but Teddy was, he was the one that started this in a lot of different areas. At any rate, I would encourage the people out west to stick with the Constitution and, in essence, instruct your state legislators that they're violating their oath of office when they want to entertain doing this stuff, and tell the federal government, the EPA, and everybody else to get the heck out of the state. Now, it's easier said than done, but that's what has to happen to fix this. Economics will follow, but if they don't follow the law, they can pretty much do anything they want to do, right?
Well, I think our state legislature, at least the one that I'm closest to, agrees with us about the national park. The problem we have here is our own congressman, Scott Tipton, will not stand up publicly and say he's against the national park because he's afraid he's going to get beat up in the newspapers over in Denver, and then it'll cost him votes. Now, I think that's precisely why he's supposed to be in Congress, is to stand up on his principles. Obviously, we've got some folks that don't do that. This Saturday, we are having a meeting here in Grand Junction. Our wonderful Senator Udall is going to be here, and so is Congressman Tipton, and I plan on being there to give them both a piece of my mind, which I really can't afford to give away. But that's what you have to do.
And let me go ahead and give another reason why we exist. We're called the Friends of the Colorado National Monument, because we want to preserve the monument. The problem is, with the National Monument, we already have BLM ownership. Theoretically, they think they own it. And we have National Park Service Management. So we have two huge bureaucracies already pretty embedded here. It can actually get worse, and that's what we're fighting. But part of the challenge that we have is to educate the public, because so many people, including good conservative people, really don't understand where federal and state and local overlap and why they should not overlap. And so much of this comes out of Washington, and so much of it is good feel-goodism, and there's a lot of pork in the formation of national parks, too. A lot of it is political favors done for friends, and, you know, that could be at play here. But nevertheless, we have these things coming out of Washington that affect the people locally. Well, the people locally hear the term national park, and, oh, my goodness, that's a good thing. Our national parks are the crown jewels of the country. When they don't understand the implications to their freedom and to the economic viability of the area and to the long-term projection of, you know, the National Park Service is a terrible manager. They have backlogs of maintenance projects in the billions. They are always over budget by the millions. And yet we have dilapidated facilities because it's government and they can't manage anything. But nevertheless, the public, because, you know, of the prestige of a national park, is kind of blind to that. And so part of the challenge is not just re-educating people about the Constitution and the roles of local, state, government, and federal jurisdictions, but also, you know, what power they have and what they stand to lose when they trade their freedom for a little prestige or, gosh, a nice national park in our backyard. And it's a huge challenge to walk people through that process to show them this is how this has happens. This is how you have to stop it. And if you don't stop it, we slowly are overtaken in every aspect of our lives. And it's a tall order to do that.
Yeah, and this past weekend, the past superintendent of the monument, Joan Anselmo, had an article in the local paper, which is absolutely pro-national park, where she said that all of our fears are just there's no worries about it, just not going to happen. The problem is that we all know the way Washington works. And we know that those bills are going to be changed. We know that it's going to affect the local area tremendously. I want to know where they're coming up with their projection figures, because this will be the second smallest national park in the United States, and it'll be the closest national park to a highly urbanized area, period. Because Grand Junction has almost 70,000 people in it. Mesa County has 150,000 people in it. And that's with losing the 8,000 jobs that we lost. If they were to put the national park in, I think it would probably gut our population by maybe 30%, because there wouldn't be jobs here for them. We have a lovely college here, Colorado Mesa University, fine educational institution. We have no jobs for these kids because we don't have the industry necessary to give them jobs when they come out of college.
And those are all fine arguments, but those in government take an oath, and that's where you lose it. The people, I had a representative tell me, because he said that his constituents didn't want a Republican form of government in the county. And I said, it doesn't really matter. If 100% of the people in your constituency doesn't want it, I don't believe it. But nevertheless, you have a duty to make sure they have it. It's a constitutional oath of office that you took. And that's the argument. And the other will take care of itself, because those are results of the fact that the government at all levels are not following their oath of office. And I hope that people realize that there is no authority whatsoever for the central government to come into your neighborhood and tell you what to do. They don't have it. And frankly, if your sheriff was doing his job, they wouldn't be there. And that's I realize that it's very important to get the people to understand, and other things that you talk about, they feel, and this idea of violations of the Constitution are somewhat, I don't know, intellectual, maybe distant, but that's the cause of the problem, and that's how you're going to fix it. And the leverage you have over those who are elected is they all take an oath, and if they don't take it, they're not legitimate. They have no authority. And when they act outside of that authority, that is null and void, whatever they do, color of law.
Well, Marjorie and Kevin, there's a, there's a question for you right there. Which one of your sheriff candidates, because you got an election for sheriff going on this year.
Yes, we do.
Which one of your sheriff candidates are taking a stand against these criminals that think they want to steal that property?
I'll let you speak to that, Kevin.
We actually have about 5 candidates for sheriff right now.
Yes.
We have 2 Republicans, we have an unaffiliated candidate, and we have 2 write-ins. In the Republican primary, we have a gentleman that has no law enforcement experience that's running for sheriff that is a constitutional sheriff, and he will stand against the federal government as the intrusion. On the other side, we have a gentleman who's been a state senator for the past 4 years, has been over in Denver for 8 years now, and I believe has passed 3 to 4 bills that actually increases the federal government power as far as arrests, rights, and things like that in Mesa County. So it's pretty clear as far as the Republican primary, we've got one constitutional sheriff candidate and one that's not.
Well, I'm going to name one of the names, and I'm going to let you name the other one. But when Steve King started trying to push that bill giving the Secret Service police powers within the counties, I attacked him properly. I didn't do it. You know, I wasn't rude. I was just direct, but I attacked him on his Facebook page, and he not only erased my comments off this page, but he shut off all comments because he knew I wasn't going to stop, and he knew that I had good information that would defeat what he was claiming.
Right. And you picked a non-constitutional sheriff. John Pennington's the constitutional sheriff candidate that we have. Steve has actually passed 3 bills just like the Secret Service one already that gave arrest powers to federal agencies. And we talked about it a little bit tonight in a group I was with. That right now in Mesa County, if a federal agent saw you with a 30-round clip or let's just go to seize you, light up a joint, since marijuana is now legal in Colorado, they could be within their rights to arrest you, the sheriff, without contacting the local police authority at all. Because Steve King has written that into those bills that he passed. Started when he was a state representative and continued last year with 13013, which got passed, gave more police powers to the federal government. It's a frightening thing. 72% of Mesa County is federal lands. My contention is that just like our Enabling Act says, just like every other state's Enabling Act said, you know, these lands are in trust for a reasonable amount of time. Well, there have been 4 states submitted to the union since Colorado joined that have gotten their public lands back, but we haven't gotten ours. To me, that null and voids the contract with the United States, because that's what the Enabling Act is. It's the contract that brings Colorado into the union. When the federal government doesn't keep up with that part of the bargain, I think it voids the contract, and I think that it allows Colorado to withdraw from the union and resubmit itself and regain control of the land. So, but we're going to have quite a tussle. So,
Let me ask a question. If they put a provision in some sort of agreement to admit Colorado as a state of the union and put that restriction that says that the United States can hold certain lands in Colorado for some period of time, that was unconstitutional when they did it, and so it's null and void. You don't have to argue this. That land belongs to Coloradans. And
oh, I know.
The United States government doesn't have any authority to do that. And there lies the argument that I would suggest that everybody ought to be talking about and saying, you know, prove where you have any lawful authority to be in this county or in this state. You don't.
And we have a very strong...
The people have been brainwashed since the war between the states. And frankly, you do it every time you pledge allegiance to the flag. One nation, indivisible. That's baloney. All right? This is a federation of union states, and we've lost that because of the dumbing down and the perversion and usurpation. I hope people start focusing on the cause of the problem and will solve it in your county with the people in your county and with your sheriff. And frankly, your governor ought to be doing the same thing. He's, he may be a lost cause, but you can do it on your county level. You can.
Can I speak to the educational piece just a little?
Sure.
I'm a teacher, but I'm also a political activist and an operative. But part of what we're doing as Friends of the Colorado National Monument is to educate people. And we want to win the hearts of the ignorant. And I hate to be so, you know, brusque, but most people are ignorant. But we have to win their hearts before we can win their brains. So what I've done is created a Facebook page, and I'd love all of your listeners to go to it. It's ColoradoMonumentFriends.com. Sign our petition, but use that opportunity to become educated about national parks, about what happens with poor government management, about what happens to freedom and access to our public lands when these things occur. And also like our Facebook page, which is Colorado Monument Friends on Facebook, or Friends of the Colorado National Monument, and like that. Because in order to win brains, first we have to win hearts, and we have to let people know that they're not alone with this opinion. And so it is kind of a process. Once we have that, then we can teach them about the Constitution, how to elect the right people to enforce the Constitution wherever we may be. So it is a process, but I would ask your listeners to support this effort. It's especially important that we have numbers, you know, in visitations and Facebook likes to show our representative and our senator on Saturday that we don't want this. The people do not want a bigger federal footprint in Western Colorado. We want a smaller footprint. But we for sure don't want a bigger one, and we're going to fight this one step at a time, however long it takes to get back the power that we the people have and to retrieve our public lands from the federal mismanagement and the federal oppression and suppression of our rights. I grew up in eastern Utah. I saw what happened when Arches National Monument became a national park and how uranium died, how drilling died, how all of the mining industries except salt and potash, but everything else died when that became a national park. Thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs, thousands of families displaced because of that. So this is in my heart, but we need to educate people. So I do invite your listeners to give us some support. Moral support is good, but please get on that website and that Facebook page and give us a like.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, but I think your time is extremely short if you realize what's really happening.
I agree. I'm sure you do.
And maybe it's not an either or. It's while you're winning their hearts, you help them understand that what the law really is.
Uh-huh.
And that gives force to what you're saying. It says they're supposed to follow the law. They're not. And frankly, our challenge is to help people understand that they're not. And I think you can do that at the same time. I really would encourage you to do that.
Mm-hmm. You bet. You bet.
Do you think that it's by accident that this is all going on in Mesa County now and that Steve King is now deciding to run for sheriff? Do you think it's by accident that's both happening at the same time?
No, absolutely not. This is part of a long-term plan. This, and the plan was set in force probably a century ago. But this is the end game in a long-term plan to literally take control of our lives, to take control of our lands and push the population into urban areas. You know, that's clear to me. I don't know. What do you think, Kevin?
Oh, no, it's obviously. I separate Steve King out of this. Steve King is just, for want of a better word, he's just a small-time politician who's always wanted to be sheriff in this county, and the opportunity came up because our sheriff's term limited. I don't think he's going to win the office. I hope he doesn't. But I think that the plan put forward by Udall to turn this into a national park, I think it's all part of a plan that Governor Hickenlooper's in on. I view Western Colorado as the experimental point for every bad policy the Obama administration is trying to pass. We've been borne the brunt of the gun policies. We're the most expensive area as far as the Affordable Care Act. Common Core is coming our way. We just go right down the line. Every policy that they want to experiment with, they're experimenting in Colorado because they know if they can get away with it in Colorado, which at one time was a very, very strong red state and now has turned purple, that if they get away with it in Colorado, they can implement it anywhere that they want. The good news is we have a very strong local public lands group that's been started by a man named Brandon Siegfried, who is a hero. I mean, he has stood up and he is fighting the BLM because they want to close about 67% of the roads on the federal lands in Mesa County, and he's standing up to them, forcing them not to do that. Marjorie and her group that I'm a part of, heroes for standing up. Scott Tipton had better know that if he doesn't take a stand on this national park, he needs to quit his office. And we've got a guy named David Cox that I know will go to Congress and stand up for the rights of the citizens of Mesa County over the federal government. We have people that are standing up. The problem, like you said, is how much time do we have? Marjorie and I have been involved in the push out here in Western Colorado for probably 5 or 6 years now. And the problem is that some folks on the right want to maintain their power over their principles. And that's where we run into problems out here. Can't grow a group big enough because, well, for frank brief, Marjorie and I are considered lightning rods. Even though we speak to the truth of what's going on, we can't speak in public because it draws opposition. It's amazing to me. You know, it's amazing that in Colorado right now, it's a bad word to use constitution in the sheriff's race. It's an incredible turn of events in the state and in the country.
Well, we have another one of your Western Slope folks that just raised their hand. Let's see who this is. 970-210. Would you like to say hello?
Hello, this is Linda Bestlin.
Oh,
hello,
know,
Linda.
I'll mute her real quick so she won't be able to talk. Hi, Linda.
Hello there. Hey, I would just like to comment on the public land grab. And one thing that I would really like your listeners and for all of us to get our head around, there is, like Marjorie said, there is a big plan. And the plan is, you know, people talk about Agenda 21 and the sustainable development. It's so much bigger than that. And there are two websites that I think that everybody should go to. One is the IUCN, and that's the International Union of Conservation Networks or Conservation of Nature. The IUCN was created in 1948 by the World Congress. So the agenda, the move for taking over all life on the planet was actually thought of long before then, but that's when the big move started to happen. The United States, you can go on that website and you can search for documents regarding the United States and what they're involved with, what
the
country is involved with.
Give us the whole website, the URL. IUCN?
Yes, sir. Yep. So IUCN, I think it's IUCN.org, and I'm not by the computer because the speakers are on with your show and my husband's listening. So I can't go in there. So anyway, if we look at the IUCN, there's also the IUCN Red List. The Red List is all the wildlife that the protection of all the wildlife. That was created 50 years. It's got its 50th year this year, as well as the Wilderness Act here in this country is 50 years old. No coincidence, I think. Then also here's another one that you need to look at is Aichi, A-I-C-H-I, and that's Aichi Target Dates. A-I-C-H-I. So if you Google Aichi Target Dates, their website will come up. You'll notice that Target Dates for basically all control of wildlife, not just wildlife, but anything alive on the planet, and that's including water, air, wildlife, aquatic. There will be control of everything worldwide. Most of the target dates are all set for 2020, and that's why there's a big push make these national monuments, so much land in all these different states, national monuments, as well as shutting down the roads. So it's the big push for it is because those, the World Congress set those target dates for 2020. That's what we're looking at. That's what we're up against. Yes, there is a target set. And that so if we look at that, we bring in the whole big picture of it. That's what we're fighting. That's what we're up against. That's what we have to educate people on. And it might sound really, really scary, but if we, you know, let people know, it's not a conspiracy. It's not, you know, the Agenda 21 thing is not a conspiracy. It's bigger than that, but it isn't a conspiracy. And we have websites that are created by the IUCN, NIH, governments in there. United States is one of the governments that is involved with it. There are documents in there you can find on IUCN. I think there are 5 documents that I was able to find regarding the United States involvement. So it's not a conspiracy. It's a very real, real thing. And the shutting down of the roads on the public land, you know, with Public Land Access Association, Brandon Siegfried, our fearless leader, and Brandon, like Kevin had mentioned, has been working so hard on having roads opened. He's been working on it for probably about 4 years now, and then we just formed Public Land Access Association. And some really great things have happened. But we need to get behind these guys with the National Monument and make sure this doesn't happen. If that land is actually ceded by Congress to the feds for the National Monument, and if there's a cession of it and it's accepted by the federal government, we're in trouble. It'll never be recovered to the state of Colorado. Never, ever. So we need to get behind, I think it's the Colorado Friends of the Colorado Monument.
Yes, ColoradoMonumentFriends.com.
Yes, we need to get behind that, and we need to get behind you guys. We have to sign the petitions. I think you have a petition online. Is that correct, Marjorie?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so whatever we can do, we have to show up in numbers on May 17th.
Yep.
We have to show in numbers on May 20th.
Yep. Did we lose you?
No, I'm here.
No.
Yeah, we're still here.
I just thought it was time for me to not say anything.
Thank you, Linda. That's exactly what we needed. We need numbers. We need support. We need to win this. We have to win this.
That's right.
Is that website ColoradoMonumentFriends.com?
Yes. Yes, and it's the same for the Facebook page, Colorado Monument Friends or Friends of the Colorado National Monument on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bill Ryle. If part of that action that's taken is in relationship to a treaty, alleged treaty, another thing that people don't understand, they say that treaties are superior to the Constitution for the United States of America. It's not true. A treaty is not, nothing is. A treaty is like a statute. And that's a misinformation. If somebody's trying to argue that it's under some treaty and therefore we have to do it, this is not true.
I think
there's a lot that's not true, unfortunately.
Yeah. Marjorie, are they actually trying to transfer that under the Antiquities Act?
You know, our concern is that they will create a national park and then they'll use the Antiquities Act to grab up McGinnis Canyons, which is actually larger in area. It's now a multi-purpose conservation area. And then the Dominguez Canyon and those areas which abut the Colorado National Monument and really grab up a swath of land that reaches to the Utah border.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is part of our concern with this because that's happening right now in close to Canyonlands in southern Utah, and it's happened many, many times with the Antiquities Act, where they would create a national monument as a buffer zone to a new national park. And that also would be devastating. It would just shut down everything.
Right. Well,
who created those national monuments?
You know, again, that is a legislative process. A lot of our national monuments were created via executive action and the Antiquities Act. The Colorado National Monument was created in 1911 as a...
My question is, who? Was it the United States government? Congress?
Yes, it is. It does come from the federal government. It comes from the House of Representatives and the Senate.
So 1911, that's Teddy, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
And they don't have any authority to do that. They never did.
That's right.
That's the way to win this argument. Tell them they had no – make them prove that they had authority to do it, and they don't. They don't.
You know, I believe Brandon is going to present that argument on Saturday to our representative and senator. I hope he does.
He is. I spoke with him today.
Yeah.
Yep,
he's the one to do that.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and that's all right. Under, you know, the Constitution says that they can own land within the 10 square miles. I think that, Bill, you had said that. And the 10 square miles in the District of Columbia, Fort Arsenal, Post Office, Magazines, and then territories, which there are no territories in the country anymore, and then the insular possessions, and those are the islands, like the American Samoa that they have, where the land has actually been ceded. That's the scary thing. They can't have anything else, but if they cede the land, it will never be returned. That's
correct. If they see something without authority, the people absolutely have the right to take it back. And that's what you folks have to do, and we all have to do that. And that is to stand together and say, no, get out of here. And if you give them an inch, of course they take a mile. And that's what they've been doing all these years, haven't they?
They have.
Under Teddy Roosevelt's concept that if it isn't prohibited by the Constitution, the president can do it. That is 180 degrees away from
the law. Unfortunately, the vast majority of Americans believe that. That's all they know. And they believe that that's the way it is.
Linda, well, that's a great opportunity to fix that.
Linda, you've been to the ASOI.us website, correct?
Yes, I have.
Have you read the Universal Orders of the People?
You know, I have, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that that's a really great website and the information that you have on there, and those initiatives, the thesis that are on there regarding the initiative of the people and the people's rights. And I think another thing would be really important for your listeners to go there and really check that out. I would advise everybody to, because
I was wondering, and Doug, you're on with us, right? Doug? You have a live mic, I believe. He might be muted. At any rate, that would be excellent to print out and pass out as a flyer on Saturday.
Right, it would. I can
do
that.
What is that, Linda? And I can do that, or you can just send me a link, and I would happily do that. I can take care of that.
Okay, wonderful.
Excellent, thank you.
Have you read it, Marjorie?
I have not. I have not. I've been chin deep in research just on the national parks and the economic implications of national parks and the mismanagement and the horrible history.
That Order of the People was written by Stephen Hance, who may be listening tonight. I helped edit it a little bit, but that's, you know, I'll give Stephen most of the credit for that one. My signature is on it, so when you pass it out, they'll be seeing my signature at the bottom of it, along with the other originators of the document.
Okay.
We're having people can go online and sign it online, but it addresses specifically the federal jurisdiction, orders all of the federal agents to cease and desist with their operation within the state until such time as it can be determined under what authority they are functioning in our state.
And guess what? They can't come up with it.
it also empowers any constitutional sheriff or any other officer to arrest any of them that continue to usurp their jurisdiction in our state when they don't have it.
You know,
so believe,
Terry,
me, believe me, that's
what
a
I
pretty
would,
powerful document.
All right, what I would suggest is that that's a fine document, but that authority, that power, already exists as a matter of law. And the problem is the people in the counties need to stand up and say, we're not going to do that. We're not going to allow you. That's, we talked about nullification before. It's exactly what you're talking about. Have that sheriff or have the people form a militia in the county or in your state. That's a bad word, I know, but that's the lawful remedy. And again, the United States government has stolen, allegedly, our militias. I wrote a paper on that not too long ago. The point is, that's the remedy for the people to just stand together and say, nope, we're not doing that. Now, I realize there's a lot of people out there who've been lulled into or want some for nothing or whatever. They'll go along with this, and maybe they're just ignorant, as you said earlier. But truth is powerful stuff. It really is.
Well, Udall is up for election, and this is a perfect topic to get people motivated to get out and vote against that guy and get him out of office. Now, I got to tell you that I do not believe that Colorado is truly turned to the to a Democratic state. I don't believe that. I believe that there's been corruption in the election process and in the vote counting that has caused that to happen. I mean, we've got precincts that had over 100% votes for Obama.
We did too in Pennsylvania.
Those precincts don't exist.
Yeah.
There's not a single precinct anywhere that can legitimately have over 100% voting for a single candidate.
Well, and I'm going to play prophet just a little bit, and I think we're going to see more of what we saw at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada, what we're seeing in Texas, what we've seen in Utah. It's going to be your rugged people that rise up. In Colorado, the uprising will occur out here on the western slope, and we need an uprising. An uprising does not mean violence, but it has to be one where the people are angry enough to confront the government and tell them to get out of here. And that will happen. The true character of Colorado is red. We are still a conservative state, but that legislative power is in the hands of Democrats and liberals. But it doesn't reflect who we are, and I think that we will see more of these sagebrush rebellions, if you will. And, you know, Colorado will be in the west, and it will be over land, and it will be over our access to the treasure under our feet that could actually benefit the entire world if we could just get to it. So, you know, I agree with that. I don't know if you want to call it revolution, if you want to call it uprising, but I think little by little, we the people will be putting government, Washington, D.C. government, back in its place. But, you know, it's going to happen in our own localities. It's going to be a hometown effort for that to occur.
County by county.
Yeah.
I think that Colorado is not a completely a blue state yet. I think they've gerrymandered, especially the House of Representatives in Colorado, through the Supreme Court here, gerrymandered it, so that will be a Democratic majority for some time. Because if you look at the way they gerrymandered the districts, they set it up so that the Democrats could control it. I think the Senate's going to go Republican this year in Colorado. However, I don't think we have a candidate for governor that's going to be able to carry the water. That's my fear. I think Cory Gardner's going to beat Mark Udall. I think Mark Udall's overstepped in so many areas. In fact, my wife answered the phone tonight and was a group in asking her opinion about Mark Udall trying to grab Brown Canyon down in down around Alamosa, I think, to turn it into a national park or a national monument now. And she just let him have it. I mean, this Mark Udall is trying to gain votes by doing this. Oh, we're going to make your area special. It's going to be a national monument or it's going to be a national park. And like we had said earlier, it's that prestige of, oh, we have a national park in our backyard. that people don't think about the dangers of what that's going to mean. You know, they're going to use an environmental stand here that the air quality in the valley is bad all the time. Well, that's because of the way the valley is made, the natural inversion area, no way around it. So anytime you have any type of pollution, it's going to get trapped in here sometimes during the days and the weeks. But it's like, did you guys read the study on the air study over on the East Slope in Weld County, where they flew the airplane over and it said 8 times the amount of benzene and 3 times the amount of methane than what they were expecting? They did no baseline study to get those numbers. So it's 8 times what? 3 times what? They have no scientific background to back up their cases. But this is the propaganda that our newspapers are putting out, that people are, oh, my God, there's 8 times the benzene or there's 3 times the methane. But there's no baseline study to back up those numbers.
Everything they do, it's like Pat Shannon's book, and Pat's a good friend of Red's, and he's getting to be a pretty good friend of mine. He's certainly doing a good thing right now, working on promoting Schaefer Cox's false arrest. You know, Schaefer's out of Alaska. Right. Gene Brokaw, one of the advisory council members, is in our chat room right now. He's out of Alaska, too. But Pat wrote a book, and the title of it was called Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. Well, when it comes to scientific represented fact from this government, you can bet, you can count on it, all, I'd say 99% of the time, whatever scientific fact they come out with is no fact at all. It's nothing but phony science. It's totally phony science. The Endangered Species Act is based on it. Blowing up hydroelectric dams is based on it. The whole wolf thing in Montana was based on it. It's all phony science. They can't tell the truth if they try. But they put it out there in such a way that dumbed down people who don't do their own research buy into this garbage. And that's exactly what's going on right now with your situation over there with the park. There's absolutely nothing to be gained for the people to turn that thing into a national park. What it does, it allows them to drive the people off of resource-rich territory. It's just more of the same attack on private property rights. That's what it is. Now, we need to make this point clear to the people of Colorado, and they need to understand that Mr. Udall is nothing but a liar.
Right. My first question is going to be, Mr. Udall, how can we trust anything you say when you purposely attempted to fudge the numbers on enrollments for the Affordable Care Act here in the state? How can we trust anything you say about this? Because you've lied to us on this. We know the study exists that say we're going to ban fracking within 100 miles. We've seen the paper. So we're not stupid here. How can you think we're stupid that we don't understand how Washington works and what you're doing? And Tipton, you need to stand up and say no, period. And if you don't want to do it, get out of the office and let us put someone in there who will.
And, you know, I think that another place that we should go with these guys is that we know we aren't stupid, and we know that there are directives, international directives, that are sent to Washington, and they're just little shills. They're big government shills that do exactly what they're told. You know, Udall isn't different. And I'd go so far as to say that he's a little puppet doing exactly what he's told to do. And that's what this land grab in Colorado is all about. They're just doing what the directives that go to Washington from the international level. You know, and so when we look at that, I mean, that's not a very pretty thing, and that's pretty scary when these guys are, even the Supreme Court has gone so far as to say that they're looking outside of this country to international law. It's just wrong on every level.
Well, the Supreme Court's a social organization now, and has been for many years. I might suggest, and this is what I try to get people to do, is you have, if it's a federal congressman or a senator, all right,
the first thing to ask him is if he's read the Constitution and has he taken an oath, and then quote the provision that says they can't do it. If he's taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and the only authority he has in office is based on that oath, that he's supposed to guard the Constitution, and he's saying, hey, we're going to turn this land that doesn't belong to the United States government, contrary to Article 1, Section 817, there's no authority whatsoever. So tell me how you have any authority, Senator. And this vote has to be no. I help people get really down to the brass tacks of where the authority is. I usually say, did you run for office? Yes. Did you get elected? Yes. Did you take an oath? Yes. Do you get paid? Yes. Then why aren't you doing your job according to the Constitution? That's how simple it is. And then you have a lot of people around the room. This happened to me once, and with a congressman that I'd known for years. And then somebody spoke, and then he turned around and they said, I agree with me on what I had said. And they did that all the way around the room. It happened to be about the Affordable Care Act. And this particular congressman, subsequent to that, kept saying it's unconstitutional, I won't vote for it. So we had a way of motivating him, I guess is what we're saying.
Marjorie, we're down to about 3 minutes left. Do you have a final comment?
You know, my final comment is just ask your listeners to support us. These little fights are worth fighting. They're little battles. As we win a battle, we'll go on to win a bigger one. But please visit ColoradoMonumentFriends.com and like our Facebook page, Colorado Monument Friends on Facebook, or Friends of the Colorado National Monument. Just give us your support and take on these battles in your own homes. They are all over the country, especially in the West. But take them on. Fight the government. Fight the ignorance of the people, and you know, spend some time every week fighting one of these battles. There's just too much at stake. But thank you for having me on tonight.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Marjorie. Kevin, did you have a final comment?
Just to reiterate what Marjorie said, we've got to fight. I would extend it out. We need to call, the Marco Rubios and everybody else and tell them, look, if this bill comes up, oppose it. Do not allow this to happen. It's a land grab. And then, yes, stay in the fight. That's the hardest thing for us in Western Colorado. People are standing up. We need to know people are standing up for us and with us. So get on these websites. Help us out. If you're in town, come by the 17th. If you're in town, come by the 20th and stand with us. Thanks for having me on. It's a great, great pleasure.
Thank you, Kevin. Linda, you got about 1 minute here.
Well, I think that I would say the same thing as educate, educate, educate. Get the word out there on the land grabs and what they're doing and what it really is all about, not only the land, the water, the air, the control that they're seeking over the animals. And let's stand up, all stand together, lock arms, and back them down. So, and thank you, too. Thank you also. It was a pleasure, and thank you for having Kevin and Marjorie on, and let's win the battle. We're going to win the battle. We just don't know when.
Well, Bill, I would say that this is people need to see the spiritual battle that's going on with this. That land was given to the people by the Creator and told to subdue and to take dominion. And I believe that's what the people have got to do. And they've got to run the feds out of there because they do not have the jurisdiction. You got 1 minute, Bill, to make your final comment.
Well, you're absolutely right. It all comes down to what's right and wrong, and that's certainly a spiritual battle. But the bottom line is we have laws in this country, and they're written down, and they're being violated every day. And the people, unfortunately, have gotten accustomed to that, and that's sort of the new norm. And the remedy is to understand how it's supposed to be as opposed to the way it is and get back to a constitutional republican form of government at all levels. So I would encourage everybody, and I think it's great what everybody's doing, is to demand. Don't ask, but demand that those in government follow their oath strictly according to the original intent of the documents. And by all means, keep up the fight because it's up to the people. But we got to follow the law in order to make it happen, I think.
Thank you very
much
for having me on again, by the way, Terry.
Thank you all. Thank you all for joining us tonight. And, Red, are you still there?
Oh, I'm here, but I need 30 minutes.
You only got 30 seconds.
This thing has been building for a long, long time. I run a job in Yellowstone Park for a contractor in 1962. And the environmental guy in control, and he watched over our shoulder every minute. He was from the Netherlands or Belgium, I don't remember which. He couldn't hardly speak English. And that was 1962. So it's been going on for a long time.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Thanks, listeners. We'll see you next week.
I'd like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a state trooper, it may be a young turk, may be the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Maybe a construction worker working on a home. Might be living in a mansion. You might live in a dome. You may own guns and you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord. You may even own banks. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yeah, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. And maybe somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Call me Bobby, or you may call me Zimmy. You may call me RJ, you may call me Ray. You may call me anything, no matter what you say. Still gonna have to serve somebody.
Yes,
you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, and it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.